If I saw Kristen go in front of me, I'd be suggesting the phone.
Welcome, everyone. This is our Wolfcast review of the fifth episode of House of the Dragon, We Light the Way. We are the Vassal of the Kingsgrave. And just to remind everyone that this could potentially spoil all published works by George R. R. Martin, including Fire and Blood. So, yeah, we kind of know who wins this war. So if you don't want to know, don't stick around. But we won't be spoiling Game of Thrones, the show, from season 4, 5 to the end, because some of us, including me, have not watched it. Also, listeners, a warning that we are going to be talking about suicide, suicidal thoughts, and sexual violence in this episode. So take care of yourselves and don't listen in if that's triggering for you. So I'm Mary, and I'm Mary on Discord. I'm joined today by Bina.
Hey, it's Bina007 on the Discord. I also want to say, if anyone has watched Formula One Drive to Survive and wants to talk about it in depth, please contact me on the Discord. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Bina. We also have David.
Hi, David. David HHH on the Discord and the forums, if they're still around, and everything else.
Elle, do you want to introduce yourself in case you have to correct our shocking lack of knowledge?
Yeah, Elle Nettles on Discord, and I'm only here in my Historia capacity. Thank you.
All right. We also have Jock.
Jock. Jock, both real life and on the Discord.
Sarah.
Hey, it's Sarah, a.k.a. Dr. Blood.
The Toll.
Hey, hey you. Hey, guys. A bit under the weather, but I needed to vent, I think. So,
thank you for your sacrifice. And we also have Xander.
Hello, Lord Baron in the VOKverse.
Okay, so full house. Welcome, everyone. We'll start with ratings, lemon cake ratings. I'm going to do it in the same order. Bina, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I think last week's episode for me was so brilliantly George and nuanced, and the writing was so good and layered, and the ambiguities were intentional and thought-provoking. And I think this episode was almost the opposite, right? Because it was all action, you know, so much happened. It's all setting up plot for the time jump. I found it less satisfying, but still good, but I don't know, maybe like if I was a 5 last time, maybe a 3.75 this time.
All right. David, what's your opinion?
I'm going to give it a 4.5. It wasn't perfect, but I definitely liked it. It, you know, was a Game of Thrones / this world wedding. So, you know, a lot was going to happen, and it certainly did. And it was eventful, and it all made sense. And... you know, even if it wasn't word for word what we got in the books, it all does make sense from what we know from the books. So I can take that as, you know, our extrapolations of what's going on in this world, since we didn't get exactly, you know, from the book, it, you know, with it being a history, we got sort of interpretations and some things left out. So, but it all fits to me, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I agree. I think it's one of the things that make this story really good for adaptation, because there's room to change a few things. Elle, do you want to give us lemon cake ratings or?
Oh, very similar to Bina. Last week, I felt was a lot more personally fulfilling for me in that kind of capacity. Definitely more action this week compared to last week, but I was definitely more satisfied last week, though I was still rated really well, probably a 4.5 for me for this particular one. Lots of action, definitely full steam ahead. We're really kind of, I'm seeing that nice descending kind of thing going on, so I really appreciate that. So yeah, that's about right.
Cool. Jack, what about you?
probably would be about 3.5, but I have to give it a whole extra point for Laris's strong performance. So,
yeah, Laris strong. Like, he felt like token-esque within. He'd escaped from Lings of Power and just invaded the scene.
All right. Sarah?
I will preface this by saying I think it was brilliantly acted and all of the characters were well serviced, but I felt like in terms of pacing, this episode was the least satisfying for me. I felt like we were in an AP class and the exam was coming up and we were just trying to cram in all the stuff that needed to happen in time for the jump. So, you know, all that said, I think I would still probably give it a 3.8 or even a 4 because the show overall is still brilliant. But I was much less engaged with this episode and I felt like I was just trying to keep up, which I did not enjoy as much as some of the other ones.
Yeah, same. Patrick, what about you?
Well, let's start out by saying I think that the show in general, and the production and everything, is better than most TV. And by that merit, it is should be, you know, valued higher. But if you just see it as a HBO production of a George R. R. Martin book, I think that this episode felt the least like his story and the most like A Game of Thrones, which I'm sorry to say to any listeners who still like it, I have soured on. So I felt completely disengaged in most of the time, in most of this, because it basically was all the things that I didn't like with Game of Thrones. So I'll give it a 2.5. And that's not compared to other shows, is compared to itself and the material it's provided by now, for now. So, yeah, 2.5.
Okay, so you're our low rating for the week, at least until Xander says his piece. I don't know what you thought about it.
Yeah, I'm going the opposite direction. I love this episode. Because, I didn't watch Game of Thrones past, a little bit of the second season, so to me this is just, it feels so A Song of Ice and Fire in a way I can't describe, that I'm just loving it. So I'm giving it 5 out of 5 Kristen Cole meat pies.
Oh. Oh wow,
there you go.
Okay, so I rounded up, I think I'll give it a 3.5 myself, so almost, yeah, quite low compared to you guys. I was just really not okay with all of the very explicit violence in this episode specifically. I mean, not all of it is explicit, but it just, I didn't feel good afterwards. So that might just have been my mood for the day. But yeah, the whole combination of violence, so many things happening and not really understanding what's going on. Even though I kind of know the story, it didn't feel very good. So yeah, 3.5 for me. So yeah, so many things happen in this episode that I felt like the easiest way to deal with it would just be to go in the order of the episode and just trying to tie things together a bit. But so I guess the first thing we see is Rhea's death. So that's Daemon's first wife, the one he hates and he didn't want to go back to in the Vale. The show definitely, that it strongly suggests that he caused her death. Although it's kind of unclear if how much bad luck is involved there. What did you guys think about this first scene?
I like it just because I feel like the show is making Daemon too likable. And I like stuff like this to make him seem, you know, show how much of a horrible person he actually is.
I also like it because I think it's the show writers trying to show when you have these ambiguous moments in the book, because they have multiple narrators or it's just a throwaway line, they try and put that ambiguity in because you can litigate how far he was responsible. I think it comes down to me thinking, why is he alone in the middle of nowhere, covered in a hood without an obvious dragon if he weren't there to kill her? But obviously the fact that her horse rears as she goes to get her bow and is startled maybe brings some ambiguity. But to me, Daemon is up to no good. And I just love, I love the whole energy she has. She seems amazing. And, I, you know, the throwaway line again and his impotence, I think was really fascinating. I mean, later we find out that her neck was broken and her face bashed, so he must have really gone to town once once we cut away. But to me, it's like it can't be that ambiguous, because why was he there if not to do it?
I had the impression that he was trying to, or he was sort of considering grabbing the reins or spooking the horse. Or I mean, to me, it looked like he was force pushing the horse, which I did not really appreciate or understand. But but I think her neck was broken when she hit the ground because she was not moving and she didn't really react when he like stepped on her arm or anything like that. So I think that she probably would have been dead in this world either way, and he just like made sure, which I don't know where that leaves us. But
yeah, also if he left her there and she was found by whatever, her cousin or whatever, there would have been questions why he was there and what was his purpose there. So by killing her, he made sure that nobody could actually point a finger to him. So, yeah, I think it was necessary in his psycho mind.
I agree, and that's the way I read it as well. Like, the fact that she had her neck broken from the fall, and yeah. But I was grateful that they didn't actually show us the killing blow, because I just really didn't want to see that going in first scene in the episode. And I'm kind of sad that we didn't get more time with her, because she seemed like a great character in just a few seconds we got to see her, really. So that was the first scene of the episode, and then we move directly, if I'm not mistaken, to Alison and Otto leaving King's Landing. Like, there's probably one shot of the boat, but we don't really care. Let's go to Alison and Odo's discussion, and then Laris Strong clearly manipulating Alison. And I have questions about that, but let's talk about her discussion with her father. So he clearly states the threat to Alison's children in there. Which is almost the first time it's been said that clearly, I think, which I found interesting. Like, yes, finally, let's lay out a few of the issues at play here. What did you think?
I think they used too much time on it. Not just here, but on during the whole episode. I think they really... It's one of my things I don't like about this episode is that it's so condensed into a few thoughts, because they haven't spent much time on it beforehand. So they need to hammer it in with the characters that we know, so that we know the stakes when they change the actors. It was too obvious and too forced and condensed.
I agree. I think, you know, I mean, sort of my preface to all of the points that I make is that it was brilliantly acted, but I think it was clear, yeah, that he was trying to like kind of plant this seed in her and make sure that she didn't deviate from the path that he had set her on. But I also think that it was really interesting how in that moment it was pretty clear to me that she didn't buy it, but that it very clearly set the stage for her shock and horror and what felt like otherwise a very dramatic shift from her later in the episode. Mm-hmm. So I thought that part was well done, but and I see why they included it, but yeah, Patrick, it just feels like they were ticking boxes to like set up the jump, and this definitely felt like one of those instances.
I mean, I feel like we needed a good reason for her to turn on Reyna and to make the decisions that she does and to wear the green dress. And I feel like this scene gave it to us. You know, I mean, up until now, she hasn't had as much of a personal stake in all of this. And I think they're going to come for you and your kid, and she's going to have them killed, gave the stakes that I think she needed. So, I mean, I think Alicent needed motivation, and we got it here. Maybe something may think it was driving it home a little too hard, but I thought we needed a reason for it, and we got it. And I think the audience needed to understand it too. And I think that's what this scene gave us.
But they already said that. They already said it in like they're already talking about that a lot. If throughout the other episodes that it. She's not going to be accepted the way that because she's a woman and stuff like Rhaenyra, and I think that it doesn't have to be spelled out. I think,
I mean, I don't know from our naive point of view of modern viewers who don't immediately go to murder if we don't get what we want. It's not that obvious that Rhaenyra could go this way, and actually would she actually, because this felt to me this whole episode like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like maybe she wouldn't have gone there, and maybe it wouldn't have been as like, was the war such so obvious and inevitable is my question, I guess. But we'll get there also with Corlys and Rhaenys discussion.
I mean, strategically, it feels very stupid, doesn't it? Because, or tactically, I should say. Because surely she's at her worst strength when her children are small. Surely the plot is to bend the knee, to be subservient, to swear your allegiance to the new queen. Go away and gather your strength and forces. Wait for your children to be grown. But I guess that's the time jump, maybe. But I just thought, okay. I didn't get why she went suddenly so dressing in green in this episode. I didn't feel that was clearly laid out to me at all.
I think it had everything to do with the Kristen Cole scene. But
we'll get there. Yeah.
I don't. This is such a weird, horrible way to say this, but like, I don't get that she really cares that much about her children, that this would have been I mean, obviously, like, no mother wants to see their children killed, and, you know, but it felt much more rivalrous than. I sort of have felt in the past that Alicent was like, oh, she's, you know, I'm not gonna let her do that to me or whatever. But her detachment from the kids, and also like the absence of what would now be what, like a 5-year-old Aegon, just has felt very like glaring to me. Like, they were like, look, it's a baby, and then like we just haven't seen him.
Yeah, they have to establish her as a mother who loves her children, that in some way redeems her actions, in the way that Cersei, the only redeeming thing was that she genuinely did love her children. And they haven't done that here.
Yeah.
So it does come off as like a, you know, like the best friend you have in high school where you love them, but you hate them, like your frenemies, like something out of Gossip Girl. Like, oh, you didn't tell me that you lost your virginity to this guy. And then the other one would be like, yeah, but you didn't tell me you were going to shag my dad. You know, like,
yeah, totally.
It doesn't feel like it's a Game of Thrones. It feels like the game of the sixth form common room.
Does it feels like Mean Girls at this point? Yeah, like,
yeah, it feels like
she found the burn book.
It feels like Blair versus Serena, which really dates me. 2000s.
But isn't that part of the message as well, that at the end of it, wars are brought up by just people having childish reactions and rivalries, right? In a way. So I think it's not that ridiculous that they would use that to explain why she goes to such I mean, what started all of this. So it didn't bother me so much, but it felt sad mostly, because finally we get the thing, the rivalry exposed. And it's even worse with Larys Strong, who comes up just after that discussion, and he tells her about Rhaenyra's tea from the night that she maybe had sex with Daemon. And it all comes off so obviously manipulative, and I found that not well done at all.
Agree.
I mean, just back to the previous scene very quickly. It also seems weird that she wouldn't consult her father. Okay, we can get to it in the ballroom scene maybe, but yeah, I agree. This was obviously manipulative, and she comes across as very stupid for falling for it.
I think Laris is such a caricature. Like, I mean, it's, I don't necessarily want to say that it's ableist or that it's, you know, but it just feels like everything that they didn't do to and with Tyrion to make him this kind of token, like, oh, he's evil. And, you know, he's like, he's almost like a Richard III in Moors, you know, where there's no, at least at this point, like there's no real nuance to him. And he's kind of just like that evil guy who skulks around and whispers poison in people's ears. And I was disappointed in that based on his introduction in the hunting episode, because I felt like there was going to be more to him than that. And I hope that there is, but this scene like did not pay that off in a way that I was comfortable with.
In defense of the scene, other than it being so bad that it's good, is also that he pointed to a Blavosi plant, said this shouldn't be here, and it's a perfect basically the lemon tree and Blavos sort of theorizing that Plessinger's does the perfect response to that. So,
so that's for us book readers. Yeah.
Yep.
So they're going to Driftmark. They travel by boat, which is not a good idea for Viserys, apparently. So the parents struck their bargain. They discuss things like the name of the children when they're born and stuff like that, while Rhaenyra and Lenor are having their own little bargain on the beach. Let's start with their parents. I thought that Rhaenys sounded quite wisely prudent, and I wish everyone was more like her, but I guess we wouldn't have a story if they were.
Right. True.
Yeah, and she stated that this is so weird and unbecoming for him, Viserys, to come here, ask for Lena to marry Rhaenyra, and then just leaves. And that felt weird to me as well, that he wouldn't stay, that like this didn't feel like the way it should have been done. What do you think?
Yeah, I didn't understand why they sailed for, I mean, God only knows how long, and then like stayed for the afternoon and then just dipped. Like, it was so weird, and it felt like a health resource, like a waste of Viserys's obviously dwindling health resources. And yeah, I mean, obviously, like, he needed to kind of impress the Valyrian house and Corlys, and kind of I don't know. But yeah, Marie, to your other point, like, I was really impressed at how perceptive and almost like disengaged and kind of amused Rhaenys seemed to be about the whole process. Like, she just seems very zen about everything, but yet she was still noticing the fact that he was missing fingers, like the fact that she picked up on that like instantly and you know, shifted her perceptions of it. I don't know, I really liked her character in that scene.
I mean, I think in terms of the why did they come just for the afternoon, is I think it shows how important it was that Viserys get Corlys to agree to this, and what a bad position he was there, and that he needs Corlys back, and he needs this wedding to happen. So, I mean, you know, it was probably not the best thing for him to have to go all this way for the, you know, couple of hours he was there, but it was that important that he be there and do it in person, because without him in person, it might not have happened.
I think it's just like a dog with its tail between its leg, right, kind of thing, you know. Like, hey, I fucked up, so I'm here now to fix it. I'm going to go lie down.
Basically, I have a very Asian view of this, which is Viserys should never have gone. It's ridiculous. It so undermines his authority. He should have summoned Corlys, saying, I'm greatly honoring your house by marrying your son to my heir, and you will take the terms I offer, yeah, as would any aristocratic house. I mean, and I think it's summed up in his speech later about, am I considered a good king? Yes, you bought peace, but at some extent to diminish your monarchy. And no good can come of this. One of my cousins got married, in Asian marriages, if they're arranged, it's very much that the girl's side comes to you for the engagement if you're the boy's side. And that's a total power move because the girl is always subservient. And for whatever reason, in this particular case, we as the boy's side went to the girl's side. And to this day, there will be, sorry, it's the other way around. We hosted the girl's side. And to this day, there are old aunties who say that's a bad marriage. It was a horrible marriage because we conceded ground at the outset. And that's why it ended up so badly. It's amazing. Oh, wow.
Yeah. But isn't that Viserys in a nutshell?
I mean, yeah, he conceded ground. So when they all walk into that hall at the end for the ball, cock-a-hoop, you know, coming in, boss man. And you just think, Viserys, you total, I mean, your brother may be impotent, but you're basically rendering yourself politically impotent by ceding ground. It just made me so furious for him. I was shouting at the screen, but it's beautifully played and Paddy Considine's acting is superb. Oh, so frustrating.
So this is another part of the episode that made me wonder if this all could have been avoided, or at least like who's right in this. Like Rhaenys is like, there is going to be a war, she's not going to be accepted, there's going to be fighting, and this is putting our son in danger. And Corlys is like, no, and we're powerful, it's going to be all right, and in a very confident and ambitious way. So is he like blind not to see what's going to happen, or is it easy to say for me because I know what's going to happen?
It always seems a bit like no one really understands the plight, the life of a dragon other than the Targaryens, really. I mean, it's sometimes it feels like when we deal with the other houses, there's somehow lesser in a way. In a sense that they might not perceive the whole picture, and they don't because they don't have the prophecy, but more so than that. And I think that Corlys Velaryon seems lesser than his wife in his grasping of the situation.
I didn't feel that way until this episode, and I was really disappointed. I felt like they just gutted his character in this episode, and I think part of it was the, you know, it's just a phase reaction to Leonor's homosexuality, which was just like, I don't know, but problematic, I'll say. But it just felt so like he's been such a smooth character, I guess, until this point. And he just felt like, I don't know, maybe he was blinded, Bina, by exactly the kind of concessions that you were talking about. Like, maybe he was just like, I finally got him on the ropes. And like, that was all he could think. But it just, I don't know. He didn't seem like the same character to me in this episode at all.
I have to say that I thought that specific quote was completely unnecessary. Yeah, and I don't think that Corlys is very sway or any swing swab or anything like that. He, like, the character constantly, like, yells at the small council, demands some action and stuff like that. Well, where if he were really, you know, intelligent and politically minded, he would not have done that in that way. He would try to work behind the scenes. He basically, the only way he gets his way is to go with a rogue brother and not get his way in the small council. So,
yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe I thought he was more in tune with Rhaenys and her kind of aloofness. But I mean, I see what you're saying for sure, like with the kind of demands that he was making. But I don't know. He just felt like Damon Light in this episode with like all of the drama and none of the charisma, which was very disappointing for me.
Yeah, I completely agree with Corlys. This was disappointing for me as well. Bina, you wanted to mention something about the children's name, right? Are they going to be Targaryens or Velaryons?
Yeah, and another echo of how I feel real world experience. Like, this feels like it's a fantasy based on medieval times and it should have nothing to do with modern life. And yet it feels like with Indian arranged marriages, a lot of it does. And certainly with this, it definitely felt relevant on the day of the Queen's funeral, because one of the major sources of consternation when the Queen married Philip Mountbatten was whether his children would take her name. And the concession, he wanted them to be Mountbatten Windsors, I think, and eventually they became Windsors because she is the crown and the crown should pass to a Windsor. It is the Royal House of Windsor. But it severely pissed him off, and his Otto Hightowerish godfather / uncle, Lord Mountbatten. And it's very interesting that when you see Prince Harry, who obviously has taken arguably a rebellious route, he has called his children Mountbatten Windsors, but Prince William's children are Windsors. So even in modern times, and I know a modern monarchy is something of a contradiction in terms, this question of, and you know, Philip was rumored to have said, I'm the only man in England whose children won't bear my name. It's still a talking point. I thought that the compromise was actually rather elegant. And this is where Viserys excels. In these sorts of political compromises. In many ways, he'd be a superb modern politician and a coalition prime minister, but he's a bad medieval monarch.
I feel like he does pick his battles very carefully, but like, maybe just not enough of them.
Definitely.
I think to the sort of building up to the scene, I would went up the stairs and up to the courtyard and all that. Like, I felt like Leo, he built it quite well.
Yeah, I agree with also the kind of disappointment that the seat is not a bit more grand. Like, it's so gloomy, and I guess, yes, it's raining, so that makes sense, but it doesn't feel like the castle of the second most powerful house in the kingdom. But then again, King's Landing also feels very gloomy and not very magnificent. So,
well, this is coming from Euron, so like it could be complete bullshit, but like he said, like they even have like one of the horns and like piles of gold and stuff, and was speaking about laden them because of that.
And they did have like a museum set up, which I thought was pretty cool. Like, some of the artifacts even had plaques on them, like explaining what they were and stuff. And I enjoyed or appreciated the fact that he seemed also to have a Lego hobby. And I feel like if he had spent some time sharing his city model with Viserys, that maybe they would have found a little bit more common ground.
let's build a big model, just the two of us. What about Rhaenyra and Laenor? To me, they seemed quite naive to believe that this could work and would not raise issues.
They're young and dumb.
Yeah.
Also, like, Bina, was it you that said that it sounded like the wine talk from Schitt's Creek?
Yes, I definitely felt that the explanation of some liking goose rather than duck was a direct allusion to... I love Schitt's Creek because it's a world where homophobia just doesn't exist, and it shows you a future that could be. And that description, I think, of not even being bisexual, I like the wine, not the bottle, I think has become iconic, hasn't it? And beautifully so. So I felt that this was the writers maybe subconsciously or even consciously nodding toward that, which I'm here for.
It also struck me as an echo of, I think it was Tywin saying like, oh, you know, His Majesty doesn't like vegetables either, but if we serve vegetables, he'll eat them. Kind of like there's this weird sort of elementary motif with sexual preference that runs through, like, or that it had in common with that moment, which I always thought was really funny. So I enjoyed it. And then I enjoyed the callback later where he was like, was I the goose? Like,
yeah.
So Rhaenyra Criston on the boat, quickly, again, he's naive. They're very careless around each other, in my opinion. Like, there's always people around on a boat, like sailors, making everything work the way it should work. So this didn't feel like a good place to have this private discussion about the fact that they had sex. And yeah, I got very big Aerys Oakheart vibes from Kristen Cole. This is the point where he is still heartbreaking, and then afterwards gets annoying.
Do you think, though, that this... So last week we talked a lot about, you know, whether he was into it or whether he was being abused. You know, if... I mean, obviously there's still the power issue, but, I mean, as much as he's regretting it on some level, he's really, like, doubling down on it. He's, you know, I want to marry you. Come marry me. So that makes me wonder now how much he really didn't want to do it last, you know, last week when we were talking about it.
I was still with him and maybe thinking along those lines, David, when he delivered the "you could marry me" line, because it was very, you know, it was very, very well delivered. But at the end, when she has rejected him, he becomes like white cloak incel angry that he thought this was a way to recover his honor and his cloak and to restore the power dynamic in their relationship to something that he was more comfortable with, that she would be completely dependent on him. She would have no more status. She would have no way of coming back from this thing. And I felt so like angry at the end of the scene that he was clearly in it for himself. He didn't want her beyond her agreeing to let him be the man in the relationship instead of him being her whore, which, you know, I don't know. I think he really tipped his hand at the end of that scene, and it wasn't about her at all. It was about how he felt bad for what had happened and wanted to make himself feel better. And it just made me really mad.
What had happened to him and his honor.
Those nice guy vibes really bothered me too. A lot.
Thank you.
I think I have a third interpretation, which is probably good as a reflection on their writing, that it allows for it, which is that I think he was a romantic, relatively low-born fool who had mythologized being someone who takes a vow, and that he didn't initiate it for sure. He would never have aspired to it, but maybe enjoyed it while it was happening and now has to rationalize it after the fact. And you could interpret that as it's all about him and it's quite selfish, but I think actually it's quite mournful and similarly, again, naive. She's never going to marry him. She's not going to run off with you to another city, right?
To be no one. And to I be think, a no one.
And if you do believe he was sexually assaulted and that there was no modern conception of modern consent, like that there just isn't room for consent in a world where the crown has commanded you to have sex with her, then maybe the marriage is what he needs to tell himself he wasn't raped, to tell himself that this wasn't sexual assault. So I almost see it as sometimes you read accounts which are very tragic about, you know, sexual abuse and rape victims who turn their abuser into a love story. Like people say, well, why did you stick around after he did this? Like a lot of people who are victims do, because they have to psychosexually create a narrative that romanticizes or gives post hoc agency to themselves. Like, better to think of yourself in a love story where you're rescuing this woman from the trap of monarchy, just as Meghan rescued Harry, than to think that you're the victim of sexual assault or coercion. So I'm at this point, maybe like Mikal on Dragoncast, I find myself quite sympathetic with him in this episode. He's obviously a man who's, I think he is legitimately considering suicide, and that brings my sympathy, and we'll see whether they take the character later. But actually I'm more sympathetic, Sarah, than... Although I do get the incel-y vibe, so now I have to go back and think again.
Yeah,
I mean, I appreciate that more generous reading of him as in the sort of victimized position. But I just, for me, the way that it was performed and the way that it was delivered and the way that she was so taken off guard. And this was something that I said about the last episode too, that like one of the most tragic things about these two is that they completely misread each other from the jump and then build these like very elaborate kind of understandings off of those misreadings. But his like 180 when she turned him down just gave me like that was it for me. And I don't know. I would like to sort of incorporate what you're saying, but I don't know if I.
I think they can both be true. I mean, I think the two can feed into each other pretty well. I think, you know, that mm-hmm. his victimization turns him into getting angry and wanting to take the power, and you know.
Yeah, that he was angry he couldn't fix it for himself. Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I can see that for sure.
Right.
I think they're all just dumb kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also too long don't make light. Like it's true that like he was victimized and all that. But trying to assert a power dynamic afterwards mm-hmm. of what we're attempting is obviously just going to create more problems for himself, and it's just going to be worse for himself in the long run. I think that's what we're going to see in the last of the season,
or in the short run even coming up soon.
Yeah, clearly. Okay, let's move on to Viserys, just because there's a lot in this episode about his declining health, and he talks about him dying and what's going to be said about him in the history, and no songs for him, and was he a good king? Was he a good man? Anyway, all of that. So maybe just a few thoughts on that part of the episode, and then we get to the meaty, juicy stuff.
I actually felt bad for him when he was asking, what's the strong's name?
Lionel?
Lionel, yeah. Yeah, when he was asking Lionel if he'd be a good king. At first I was like kind of laughing in my head because, you know, he's just remembered as a laughable king. But then the way Paddy Considine acts, I'm just like, you feel so bad for him.
Yeah, it's the strength of Paddy's acting that he's able to be both comedic and genuinely pathetic and inviting of our sympathy. And it comes through in his career where he's gone from comedic to dramatic to very tense roles. And in, you know, when you look at him in the context of everything we know about Westerosi history, someone who just gave peace and stability, and maybe at the expense of his own reputation by conceding too much, but he wasn't prickly. He didn't just go to war on a humbug. And maybe the best kind of monarch is actually one that is self-effacing and who doesn't worry too much about their reputation for victories and being tested in the crucible, and is willing to be seen as a bit of a weakling, but just keeps the peace, you know? Mm-hmm. But it is a little bit après moi le déluge, so maybe not.
I disagree on that specific thing, that the monarch needs to be like be able to appear weak, because if anything, we know, my opinion on that point is that any institution, be it democracy or anything, you have to have belief in that institution. And if you don't believe in the king's ability to assert himself, then people will lose faith, and that will end up at some point to strife and people going behind the king's back and doing things that will eventually lead to strife and war. So I think his weakness is what brings on the war.
Yeah, I agree. I think I could answer that he is a good man, but definitely not a great king, going by the sheer carnage of the Dance of the Dragons, really.
Yeah, well, reality aside, and like social capital and all that, like one text that we know from intertextuality is that George is very fond of is obviously the prince. And in the prince, there's the quote, appear virtuous, but don't be virtuous. And other quotes that are very related to the idea that a king should appear weak when a rabbit when they are fox, and appear a fox when they are the rabbit. So there's this very sort of Machiavellian criticism would be of Viserys' idea of government and the plan.
But the thing is, he's just a rabbit. He's just a rabbit. He's not strong or anything. He's just the bunny rabbit all the time.
I kind of feel like in retrospect that the deer he stabbed was a very striking, very sad metaphor for himself, where he's just entangled in these waves of expectation and kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you know, noble but also restrained and hunted until he just can't escape. I wondered if he wasn't just a little bit disappointed that he wasn't the one to try the prophecy. like how Rhaegar thought it was him for a while and then he realized it was probably his children instead. Like, I wonder if he's like, oh man, I wanted to be the chosen one, you know. But I don't think
talk about like, yeah, it is not a good thing to put on your children's shoulder, like the idea that they could be the chosen one. It's not great.
He was like, he didn't worry about the day-to-day because like he was pretty sure he could pull it out in the, you know, the apocalyptic crisis. I didn't think that when I was watching the scene, but in retrospect I feel like that would be kind of a funny angle on it.
Yeah. Okay, Addison, Kristen Cole, go.
I don't know. I mean, I think I have a clear understanding or interpretation or range of interpretations for Kristen Cole, which is someone who's ludicrously romantic ideals have all been crushed. He realizes that the monarchy he looks up to is just a randy, you know, the heir to the crown, the queen, is just a randy teenager. He's lost his honor. He's reduced from being, you know, he said in the last episode, I never dreamt that my name would be inscribed in the book. And now that book is soiled, you know, so he's desperate and he is suicidal. Why I find this scene hard to interpret is because I don't, as I said before, truly understand how and why and what Alicent wants to achieve. And because I'm borderline kind of really angry, actually, the more I think of it, that this epic civil war started by two very smart, powerful women is reduced to a kind of high school spat and signaled by wearing a dress, which is, you know, reducing it to, oh, I'm going to put on a dress and call my banners, you know. I don't know what she's doing there. I mean, I wait for the rest of you to give me guidance on this. I felt profoundly frustrated and dissatisfied by it.
There is no guidance. We're all lost.
I'm just trying to get clarification here, you know? She's like, wait, she did lie to me. I want proof of it now. I've heard one side of it, but I need a little backup from someone who knows. And, you know, the big tragedy of it all is that Kristen Cole, in his extreme guilt and, you know, sadness for having, you know, for what he's done and what he's done to himself, really.
The word is stupidity.
Right? That he, you know, that he in the end, you know, he in the end indicts himself unnecessarily, because that's not even what she was asking him. I mean, I actually really liked the horrible tragedy of it all, is that he kind of destroyed his own life in this scene here because of his own, you know, guilt and anger. You know, I mean, none of this was necessary because that's not what she was asking him.
I disagree with you, David, only on the premise that I don't think he destroyed his life here. I think his life was destroyed for him, and he was guilt-ridden to the extent that when he was pressed about it, he chose to do what he thought was right to get at. So I would say he's a victim in this situation still, sadly, and he is breaking. Yes, but in this situation, him feeling the amount of guilt and maybe trying to save the last amount of honor he has,
right,
is not his fault. If we go by the interpretation that he was assaulted, or
I mean, he said no, as Sarah said last week very powerfully. He was holding to his vows. He wasn't a political player, and he's been dragged into politics. He's been dragged into having the most dangerous secret in the land. Not only because just having done it, he could be at minimum killed, if not mutilated, before being killed. But now the queen knows, he thinks, because he's been, you know, unfortunately drawn out. And if he thinks the queen knows, he thinks Otto knows, he probably thinks the small council knows, maybe, you know, the former king knew. The shame of having been sexually assaulted by a young girl, the shame of having ruined your vows. I mean, the guy must be absolutely desperate. The far more interesting scene is the one we don't see, which is what Alicent truly does with that desperation.
Right.
I think that this scene was much more about Alicent for me than it was about Kristen. And I mean, maybe that's not true in terms of like the fallout afterwards, but I understood this as her sort of last ditch effort to learn or confirm or reassure herself that Rhaenyra was the friend that she thought she had and the friend that she thought she knew. And part of that, I think, was in response to the sort of bombshell that her father dropped on her, that like, you really can't count on her not to just slaughter your children if she takes over. But I think that was the shock and the dismay, was not only that Rhaenyra had lied to her, but that this was a person who, unlike Daemon, under no circumstances could be understood to have initiated. So that, you know, suddenly Rhaenyra is not only this person that she thought she knew but clearly didn't, who lied to her face and swore on her dead mother that she didn't do anything, but also someone who, you know, feels or cares so little for the people around her and the people that care about her that she's willing to do this to this man. I think all of that was a huge shock for Alicent, and, you know, maybe something that she was afraid of or something that she had started to suspect, but was confirmed in no uncertain terms by this revelation.
The double standard from Alicent is just absolutely staggering. So you're not the friend I thought you were. Well, you weren't the friend she thought you were either when you married her dad.
She started it. No, I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, yeah. But I think maybe that it speaks also to our observations last week, that not only is Rhaenyra acting very much against Alicent's interests or belief systems or whatever, but that she's doing it with an agency that Alicent was never allowed to have. So I think maybe there is that further aspect of like, she has this freedom and this is what she's doing with it.
I still don't understand why she would go from, you know, it was one thing that she didn't like the idea of Rhaenyra and Daemon having sex, but having sex with a knight, yes, of course, it's also a breach of some sort of honor. But there's nothing in his story that necessarily made it so that he went and told about what really happened. He just said that he committed the sin, I think. So I'm just saying that I think she's overreacting, sort of. And maybe because I would not have reacted that way, you can't relate to her. But I find her reaction unrelatable, actually.
Because actually, in many ways, his revelation makes her position stronger. Because she can now just go to her dad and he can tell the small council, hey, I've got this daughter with these pure-born kids. Here's this woman who's shagging, you know, her guard, and we can't trust her to be continent, and we can't trust her over the, you know, the genetic purity of her kids. I mean, surely, I don't know, nothing about what Alicent does in this episode makes sense to me. I'll just leave it at that.
I don't think she wants to be in that position. It may put her in a better position, but I don't think she wants to be in that position.
Yeah, I agree with that, David, but I also think, we've said this a few times already, there's a lot of things in this episode that seem like they checked boxes that we have to have that kind of motivation for her to be truly the Green Queen. And I think that was, all of it felt a little bit forced, including this scene. Because, yeah, I agree that from her point of view, it shouldn't be really worse that it's Kristen than if it had been Daemon, except for the fact that she could have blamed Daemon a little bit more, but I think the betrayal from Rhaenyra is the main thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's worse. I think it's just either way it confirms that Rhaenyra lied to her and that she did this bad thing, even if it's not the bad thing we thought it was.
But she still could have clung to that shadow of a doubt, I think, if it had been Daemon, because mm-hmm. he's so, you know, charismatic and seductive, whereas like, yeah.
True.
Yeah. I felt very bad for Kristen when like she asks him to come and to sit next to her and he like just the dismay on his face, just
right.
Like,
oh yeah,
where I mean, why am I in this position, was just terrible. Like these women keep putting him in the worst position ever, and yeah, I felt bad for him. But then he goes and does just,
yeah
what, and then it changes. So let's get to the pre-wedding celebrations and the wedding itself. There's a lot of it, a lot of things are hinted at here, so we get a little bit of a Lena Daemon thing that I hope we get to see more in the future. I mean, more of her specifically, because she seemed like she's great. And we get the big, like, so we have Joffrey, is that his name? Lena's boyfriend, who I have to say was pretty stupid about just going to Kristen Cole and be like, hey, I know your secret, you know mine. Let's be friends. So like, what? just so stupid. But then, did someone understand better than me what happened and how Kristen just lost it?
I have an idea. Maybe.
Okay.
I think maybe at this point, he's just trying, because he's already been spared once. He's trying to you know, keep the notion of their disgrace hidden, and Joffrey's blatant threat. It was a blatant threat. Just drove him over the edge, and made him, you know, not be able to tell the truth ever again. And I think it's one thing I just wanted to note on this one. I don't think that the arranged marriage between two people who don't necessarily, you know, find each other sexually attractive is a problem in this, you know, world. I think the problem with their arrangement was their boyfriends.
Right.
I think Kristen and Joffrey are idiots. Both. Right.
Both of them.
So yeah.
But understandably both. Understandably they're both idiots.
Like, yeah.
They weren't brought up in this kind of a setting, and they weren't intending, you know, they're both potentially going to be in a relationship with one of the most powerful people on the planet. And that's not they weren't brought up to do that, you know, or to understand that world.
Especially Kristen.
Right.
I am
probably Joffrey either. I mean, Joffrey.
I mean, his surname is, so he's Sir Joffrey Lonmouth. So I don't think he's from a very important house, clearly.
Yeah, he may as well be Sir Joffrey Manwoody, right, for the status right. that he has.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And here he is potentially now, you know, the fuck toy to the king.
Yeah, well, the king consort. I guess
he'll never officially be that.
Yeah, my interpretation of Kristen Cole going, well, you say that, but, you know, Edward II's fuck toy, Piers Gaveston. I mean, you know, there's a long line of gay... Yeah. English kings, he've had kind of basically maîtresse en titre, like you would with the, sorry Mary, I should stop saying things in French in front of an actual French person because it's embarrassing. but I mean, there have been people with kind of like official court positions, and Pierre Scavenston, and his horrible end was because people resented the power he had. I do wonder if Kristen Cole going berserker was almost a suicide attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did this thing, I lost my honor, they're going to kill me, right? Oh, they're not going to kill me. Okay, so I'm going to do another thing that's berserker. Surely kicking off randomly. I mean, whether consciously or subconsciously, I felt this whole episode, he's kind of in a self-loathing death wish, and he'll take out anyone who increases his shame, which Joffrey evidently does.
Suicide by castle guard kind of a situation. Like, why was there a delay? I mean, I understand that what Joffrey said to him was effectively a threat, and that it pushed him over the edge. But I mean, it was like if he had just pummeled him to a pulp in that moment, I would have a much clearer understanding of what went down. But the fact that it was like all of a sudden, and that like it seemed to have been linked to Rhaenyra and Daemon somehow, and I don't know. I watched the whole scene twice, and I still feel like I missed something major that like puts all the pieces together,
which is I thought that was the intention.
Exactly, that's what I was about to say.
It was so dark too that I was also watching like at dusk this morning or dawn I should say, and the light was coming in through my window, so I had trouble with it being so dark, even seeing what was happening. I'm like, wait, who was that? Wait, was that strong? Wait, who, what's going on?
Yeah, I think that was intentional, but what I didn't understand is the aftermath. Like, I didn't get how we got from that scene to just, oh, okay, marriage, and on the other part of it, Kristen and Alicent dealing with the aftermath as well. But like, how does he get to flee? How is he not arrested or something? Why don't we have like just a conversation being like, what just happened? Because if the intention was to show us how confusing it was for the characters in the scene, they should express their confusion. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Laenor still had the handkerchief shoved up his bloody nose as they were saying their vows was like, dude, right, like, just take a minute. Like, some stuff went down here that we should probably talk about. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was bad.
By the way, was anyone else expecting the moment where Laenor goes over to Joffrey's body and, like, you know, rages his despair, that to be, like, a moment where, oh, this thing we all thought was true was true? Like, I thought that was going to be his, like,
oh, my God.
I thought that was his self-outing moment, and then it
turned out. Dude, got me seriously. So bad. Like, dude, are you in the fucking Red Keep in court? Like, what are you doing?
They were already playing like hugsies during the dance, right? Like, they were not.
That bothered me too.
At all. Like, yeah, it was very.
And maybe
like,
that's why. Otherwise, how would Rhaenyra know? I mean, obviously, this is common knowledge.
Yeah. No, well, they grew up together.
I mean, wasn't Renly kind of common knowledge? I mean, the guy had a rainbow flag. Admittedly, I read the whole first book, didn't realize he was gay because I'm a moron. But yeah.
Well, rainbows weren't a thing until the 90s. So.
Yeah, but still, like, to us modern readers, and just to the characters as well, it was kind of known by the people close to him, and I think that's the same for Laenor, and like they mentioned that they did grow up together, so it's only, I mean, not recently, but it's only been a few years since they all got back to Driftmark, I guess. And beforehand, he was at court, and maybe his very dear cousin, Rhaenyra, knew.
Yeah, I think we also have to understand how the notion of someone as being gay is still a very modern concept. I mean, even 30 years ago, hell, even today, there are a lot of people who consider the idea of identity as a very modern concept. Even people today have a problem with it. There's a lot of guys who you know, and women, I'm sure, who like, this is just something they've done, but that's not who they are.
And presumably there are some people in that category, right? There are people who are, or rather it's a bit of a scale and a spectrum. And you can have dalliances but not actually be gay, but then there are lots of people gay who use that as a kind of, as a construct to avoid, well, to justify self homophobia, I guess. But yeah, no, that's a really good point, actually.
I do think it's interesting, and really speaks to the, probably on some level, to the absolutely overwhelming arrogance of House Valyrian, that Mysteria seemed to have like a much better understanding of how badly it would go for her to be caught up in Daemon's like mind games, and yet Lonmouth has absolutely zero chill that like not going to come back. I mean, obviously they're not going to do anything to Laenor, right? Because he's like the future king consort, but that they wouldn't just, you know, get him out of the way for appearances. I don't know. He just seemed his self-preservative instinct was less than zero. And I found that very shocking. In this context.
I mean, their collective self-preserving instinct, like Joffrey, same. Even Rhaenyra, like, yes, she's the princess, she's the heir, but she the whole thing make it seem like she doesn't really, she's not very careful about her whole thing with Kristen. She's not, even then, she's not careful with the way she behaves with Daemon, for instance, at the dance. And like, it doesn't seem,
yeah, that's another
it
really
seems
good.
Like all of those characters are like not real, they don't understand the violence and the cruelty of the world they live in, which is crazy.
It shows their arrogance,
yeah,
that they're above it, there can't be consequences for me. Yeah, this is there's not going to be consequences. I'm the queen.
I don't buy the dumb kid. I buy the dumb kid thing for people like Kristen Cole and maybe Joffrey who weren't raised at court.
Right.
But when you're a Velaryon who at the age of 7 is having to give a very artful political speech to the very elderly king about how you can get married and he can fuck you later, I don't think the kids in the Targaryen, Valerian, the very senior houses, I don't think they have much of a childhood. And I think it's analogous to kind of, you know, you look at the little kids doing the whole of the funeral today. I mean, the childhood of Charlotte and George is over, right?
Right.
I mean, you recognize now that one day that's going to be you, and this is a very different childhood. I don't think they can get away with the excuse of just being dumb kids.
I don't think it's that they're naive. It's, I think that they're arrogant and that, you know, we're in power and we can do what we want. And I don't think that they'll and there won't be consequences. I mean, we certainly see lots of world leaders today who think they can do anything they want and there won't be consequences. And sometimes they're right.
I think the only way that we can really understand it is that it traces back to Viserys and how they believe that Viserys won't do anything to enforce any of it. I mean, I'd, like, that's why Daemon rolled back into the wedding when he was supposed to be in exile, and like he got a chair pulled up for him. You know what I mean? Like, we see over and over again that the buck is supposed to stop with Viserys, and he's just like, whatever, you know. And I think that's one of the things that makes the strong moment so shocking later, that he actually does enforce that boundary that he's set, and like we don't. You know, it's completely unexpected from him, clearly by everyone.
Yeah, you all make incredibly good points, which I acknowledge. I mean, it is amazing in retrospect, thinking that Rhaenyra, as much as I've sort of seen her as my protagonist and the one I'm most sympathetic to, gives two shits about Kristen. There is no concern about his feelings in any of this. He makes her an offer of his hand in marriage, and she sort of, it's just, it never occurs to her.
Right. She looks at him like, what are you saying?
to her, it's just, yeah, I lost my V card with a hot knight. And she never thinks he might actually have feelings about this. It's very arrogant and very privileged. And I'm a Targ. I take what I want. And she learned it from her uncle, I guess, because she didn't, even from her dad, as weak as he is, when he had to take a second wife, he didn't take the one that was good for the crown. He took the one that was, you know, the one he wanted to bed. So why not, I guess? Yeah.
Just like, honestly, the targiest thing that he does, I feel like, in his life, which is, I don't know.
Yeah. Can I just notice that Lionel Strong, you know, gestured to his son, Harwin, to break things up or save the princess?
Fuck,
or was it?
Was,
yeah, break
such
bones.
An awesome moment.
Yeah. It was so really good. Hashtag my strong. It was a strong moment.
Hashtag,
so
hashtag, yeah,
it was,
yeah. That was awesome.
Hashtag strong moment.
Yeah.
That was good. I mean, Lionel has grown on me. He is not my strong, but he's a very good strong. And Harwin, we've been like peppered at moments with him throughout the episodes, and now he's starting to, you know, take character,
yeah,
become a character, and I like that. I like, that's good storytelling. the way you don't tell everybody that he's a strong person and he's really good at fighting, whatever. You just show it.
Mm-hmm. Just backing up from that moment, just one second. The reason that he had to do that was because how many people in that room gave absolutely zero fucks about what was happening to Rhaenyra in that moment?
Right.
Like the
right?
fact that literally no one rallied around her. Nobody cared that she was half stomped on the ground.
Right. I mean, she's could have died in the middle. God.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I mean,
as well.
And obviously, her sworn protector was.
Well, unfortunately, the Kingsguard watching her. Well, the Kingsguard who's supposed to be watching her is Kristen Cole, who's too busy pounding someone. At the moment,
but there's supposedly seven of them. And there's, I'm sure there's one other in this room.
They should all have been there. Yeah. And I mean, even Daemon just like dipped the fuck out when that went down. You know what I mean? Like,
where the fuck did he go?
I don't know. He's like, I gotta go. Like,
I know, right?
I have a real estate claim to press in the Vale. Hi.
Or to go to my wife's funeral.
Yeah, he very much is an asshole, Daemon.
I mean, they kind of all are, which is not making me very hopeful for the rest of the thing. I mean, like, I should have known getting into this that this would not be a happy story, but, this week's episode just got me like, oh my god, this is going to be bad.
This well, it's a wedding, of course it's going to be bad.
And, yeah.
It's a wedding in this world. What do you think? It's just going to go well and be happy? When's that ever happened?
Do you think George has a thing against weddings and that's why him and Paris never married?
Ooh, there you go. And imagine what would have happened if he did.
Confirmed.
I think you're right in that, Marie, that everyone's an asshole. I think even Allison is an asshole in the way we have all had that friend that's a bit too pious. Bit too self-righteous and you know saying you know judging you while you, even though you know they don't say directly to you, they're judging you, and I think that's her role. She's really just a pious asshole.
can we just take a moment for her epic shade when she called Rhaenyra's stepdaughter? That was such a beautiful moment where I was just like,
great. Yeah.
And that combined with walking out with the dress, it was like that was just the icing on the cake. The little kiss.
Mwah. So is this the scene with black and green, or will we get it the real?
We haven't gotten the black yet.
That's the big question. Will Rhaenyra wear her black dress at some point?
Yeah, is this a flip version and we'll never get the black and the green scene? Or is it just that now Allison is consistently dressing in green and then Rhaenyra will say fuck you and wear a black and red dress? I don't know.
That sounds about right, I think.
I mean, they kind of have to have the moment.
Exactly. They have to do something. Otherwise, the faction names make absolutely no sense.
Yeah, so since we're talking about the next bit in the show, how do we feel about losing some of our actors and actresses next week? Is that next week, right? We're changing casts.
Yeah, well, you can see them in the upcoming credits. Not the credits, the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I feel they're very good, but maybe the next lot will be equally good and then it'll be okay.
Just speaking about the sort of theatrical details of this, I thought that the rubies in her hair looked so cheap. And I found that just absolutely shocking that they were. Maybe I'm like not a ruby expert or something. And like the light colored ones are like the most valuable or something. But like it just struck me that they looked like stick-on gems that you would buy at it, which is so contrary to every single other detail in this world. But I was mesmerized by them in just an awful way. And I don't know why they bothered me so much, but it was so striking because everything else.
Can we get a bleed light? The amount of money they spent on this, can we get some fucking lights on?
I know, right?
I feel like I have underestimated how well Mr. Dr. Blood calibrated our television, because I have not I have not had this problem at all this season, and I keep hearing
from the moment Kristen struck the first blow, I had no clue what was happening at all.
I mean, I think they are like trying to show that it wasn't really light, because they only had like fire to light a room, which, all right, but does that mean I have to like kill my eyes trying to see something?
Yeah.
All right. Any last thoughts?
We'll say in the end, I do feel a little weird having given a 4.5 to an episode with a gay bashing in it. You know, feels a little weird. But...
Shit, I didn't think of that. Now I feel bad.
Well, I suppose the point is we're meant to see it as a bad thing, right? We're meant to see Corliss's homophobia as a bad thing.
Yeah.
I think I'd be more concerned with the fact that the only two gay characters are transparently the stupidest in the show. That's kind of funny. Yep.
Well, I mean, the other question is, it's not clear if it was just a hatred for gays, or if it was just, or, you know, for that thing, you know, or if it's just that, you know, this was the threat to him, you know?
Yeah, I will say with Kristen,
I think that's more where they were going with it.
Yeah, I think with Kristen Cole, it is more of a threat, like,
right,
you know, just that, that like toxic masculinity, like, oh, you're a threat to me now.
And I also
you know,
think
rather than a homophobia thing.
He did not appreciate his custom invitation to the side piece club. Like,
yeah,
I think
yeah,
that was very much because he had already been very sort of righteously indignant at
fucking
being a whore,
Joffrey.
But he was like, yeah, he was like, what? I'm not in the same category with you. And whether that was tinged with homophobia, I would not be surprised. But but I think that it was the
I think it was more just the dishonor of it, of being a mistress or being a side piece. I don't think it was really the homophobic thing. I think it was just how many people fucking know about my dishonor, which kind of multiplies and amplifies my dishonor because I'm a very messed up guy. But I've also just been assaulted, so actually he's messed up, I'm saying messed up not in a pejorative way. He has been messed up.
Literally.
He's very out of kilter.
I do think there was an air of, you know, who the fuck are you to be talking to me about this? Like, I don't know you. So that level of exposure had already happened. Like, I agree, be nice and see where that would. The delay is still troubling me, like, in the way that, you know, he was stewing on it and then just all of a sudden went to, like.
Honestly, that seems fair for this character. I mean, he doesn't seem that impulsive. It feels like it was one of those things that like sat in his head and he finally was like, okay, enough.
Yeah. I just feel like there had to have been some trigger that I missed, and I don't know what it was, but
so
Joffrey off camera suggested a four-way and he wasn't happy.
There you go.
Made some gestures.
If I saw Kristen go in front of me, I'd be suggesting a four-way.
Well, that's your opening bumper right there.
There we go.
Thank you, David.
I mean, we have to be Vok, right? We have to be Vok.
Do we have burning points that have yet to be said?
I mean, the wedding was super fucking depressing. And I feel like now that you've overused the rat motif, I think that's getting a little bit... Like I was impressed with
it's like half the episodes now.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I get it. There are rats, like, which again is foreshadowing that we don't need to go into, but it's starting to feel very heavy-handed in a way that it felt like world building before. And I don't know when that line tipped for me, but I think it was this use.
I was very this was a very samurai moment, the whole Kristen Cole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought like, that too.
Harakiri seppuku sort of thing he was about to do, and then I think that sort of reminded me a lot of Akira Kurosawa's movies, where sometimes they fall from grace and then they, you know, get lured into the like the antagonist's group party, one of like the spider palace and stuff like that. I like that. Actually, because it reminded me of movies that I enjoy very much. So maybe it is a nod, I don't know.
Do you think you would have gone through with it?
Absolutely not.
I don't think so either.
He seemed ready to, I don't know.
I feel like he poked himself and been like, "Oh," and then been even more mad. Like, maybe that's unfair. Maybe that's unfair. But I don't know. He's just seemed so like.
Yeah, I think it's unfair because he literally asked to be killed by the queen,
as like, opposed murder to me. Right. Mutilated and tortured. Like, tortured. I mean, yeah. I don't think
no,
he was
no,
like,
but
just
it, yeah,
he was like, if we're picking, you know. If we're picking alternatives here, I don't know. I'm
I don't know. He couldn't drink poison or something. Yeah.
I am being unfair, I think, Tim, but he really bugged me this episode. So there you go.
I do want to piggyback on what you're saying, Patrick. It definitely did give me fuck. Thanks, Sarah. I almost said Sudoku. it definitely did give me like Akira Kurosawa kind of vibes. However, I am really tired of seeing suicide or attempted suicide as plot points in shows when it's not necessary.
Thank you.
I think you can address his anguish and desperation in a much more tactful way than just like, oh yeah, he's just gonna kill himself. You know, that's what people do when they're like down, you know. I'm getting tired of just seeing it used in that way.
Especially in a glorified, like, or arguably glorified.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so I agree that it should not be glorified, but if it is supposed to, you know, hearken to a feeling of, like, the samurai honor, that sort of feels in line with the way Christian Cole is looking at his own position how he's fallen. So I think in any other case, yes, it's cheap to have a almost suicide. But in this case, I actually think it fits to his character that he is sort of like looking at his honor in the same way a samurai would, and would be if he hadn't. I think he like thinks he's expected to kill himself. So
yeah, I don't think it was. I don't think it was. I'm so depressed. I'm going to kill myself. This is what I have to do.
But maybe they could have just set it up a little better. I think I don't know. It's one of the things that I'm seeing more and more constantly, which is kind of weird, and it's an exhausting point, you know.
I thought it was interesting that there was zero mention of the wall as a potential consequence for him.
Mm-hmm. Yep, fair point.
Like, he was either going to be killed or mutilated.
That's what I mean. I'm like, are we not going to do the wall, right, sir? You're not going to. I mean, such an escalation.
That would.
I know,
that
right?
That would require explaining what the wall is to people who might not have read the books or watched Game of Thrones. I don't think there are that many of them, but that's a whole new part of the story that hasn't even been mentioned.
That's fair.
In this?
Yeah, that is fair.
Yeah.
Why did they move the wedding up?
I mean, right, I think the way I understood this was that, okay, we need to move fast and be done with this. But it doesn't really make sense. Like I said, why didn't we see like a what the fuck just happened conversation, right?
Yeah. I mean, we have had pretty substantial cut scenes before. Substantial in the sense that like they went pretty far with them before they cut them. So I wonder if there wasn't like, you know, the sea snake pushing for an instant wedding to keep his son safe, or, you know, which would have been a nice callback to Rhaenys's fears earlier in the thing, where it's like, you know, if people are taking hot shots at people at like the opening banquet, like, let's just get this shit over with so that he has the protection of the Kingsguard and there's no lingering questions as to like whether Daemon's gonna swoop off with her or whatever. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess they did just do away with the party, right? Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, we were originally supposed to be having a week of parties before the wedding, and then we just said, oh, here we are. You know, normally there's a lot of planning that would have to go into a royal wedding, and it's all just shot to shit. Oh, here we go. We're going to do it.
Are we going to be getting our Airbnb refunds back or what?
Castle B&B.
There's two points to that. I think it was, again, this is one of the instances where I thought it was too condensed. Mm-hmm. They could have made a several day time jump or whatever. I'm not quite sure how they could have handled it, but necessarily better. But this felt wrong, in the sense that we had to see him stand there and be,
you know, understandably sad and dripping blood from his I don't know, that's wrong. Second of all, no, that's just it. I don't, the other point wasn't important enough. That was just what made it, you know, drop a whole another point for me.
That was the tissue up the nose for me. I felt like, you know, I'm like, this is, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that was a good way to show that they didn't take any time to think about it, and they kind of just slammed the door shut on it. But I don't quite feel like they.
Which, to be honest, seems like a very Viserys thing to do. So, to be fair.
I guess.
Like, I can see Viserys going, let's just do this. Let's do this. Get it over with. I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah. Or that he didn't want to hear it from Sea Snake, that maybe they were going to postpone it or, yeah, I don't know. Right. Yeah.
Or cancel it. Don't give him time. Don't give him time to give it second thoughts. And not only that, but maybe don't give time to let the story go through the realm before the wedding. Like, let's make it happen before, like, everyone starts talking about it. And, oh, yeah, our moment of, you know, Laenor outing himself and all of that. Let's not give that time to fester. Let's just do it.
Well, it could be, too, that Viserys thought once his nose started bleeding that, like, that was it for him, right? And so he needed Rhaenyra married that moment so that she would be protected and have House Valyrian on her side. And, I mean, that may have been part of the urgency, too, because he was also visibly falling apart in that moment. But
And then did fall over at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was right in that.
Yeah, but still, it lacks some kind of dialogue, some kind of just, yeah, in my opinion, at least.
We needed something. Yeah. We needed something.
Yeah, we need some. I mean, it's true with a lot of things in this episode, I think, that, I mean, there was a lot of dialogue, but just we just jumped from one thing to the other really quickly all the time, and that didn't feel very satisfying.
This was lovely, guys. This has been a weird day and a weird week. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
The words of Ted Lasso. I appreciate y'all. I really do. This is the best of the community. It really is. It's so lovely. So, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Bina. It's all love. Thanks, everyone.
It is all love.
Aw.
Thanks, Marie. Should we do an official ending?
We need our woo.
Do you do that counting in or just let's go with it?
3, 2, 1.
I'm thinking too much, am I?
It's so cathartic to a roo. I mean, like, people do yoga in the morning. People just should do a louder roo. It's so uplifting.
Well, I know what I'm going to do with my first cup of coffee tomorrow.
I'm going to do an aroo every morning from now on. I bet you it improves me.
At the very blood beginning of the morning, my neighborhood spontaneously started doing that at 7 p.m. every night. So, like, we were all in our houses in this, like, crazy lockdown. Nobody was going anywhere. And at 7 p.m., you would open the window, and all across the neighborhood, people would just start howling. And it would go on for, like, 2 minutes. And then it was done, and it happened every night for, like, I would say probably about a month it went on.
That's
really awesome. Yeah, it was so cathartic, and, like, my kids were so excited about it because they got to just kind of, like, let loose. And
did that happen spontaneously? Does one person just do it?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, there were mentions of it later on, like, the sort of local, like, Facebook and stuff, but as far as I know, like, it started and people were just like, what the hell, you know, and then you would join in and then you'd hear the neighbor respond, and it just kind of traveled all, like, we live on a hill, so it kind of traveled, like, all across the neighborhood, and you could hear it, like, kind of filtering in. It was so cool. It was really cool.
I wonder if it evolved from the, you know, the applause for the first responders. I wonder if it maybe evolved from that. I don't know.
It felt much more primal than that, but
yeah. We did the clap for the NHS, and then in Philip's block of flats in the first lockdown, every Saturday at 3 o'clock, because he has, like, professional grade speakers, they would do half an hour of songs, and people on the apartment block could, like, request songs, and everyone would go on their balconies and dance. Oh, wow. Which is really cute. And then he blew He blew one of his really expensive speakers, so then he stopped.
Oh, no. Another victim of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In Denmark, we had nationalized, televised singing every day, both in the morning and the evening. So you could.
The wedding, watch. Isn't it? That's a bit like Physical Jerks, Big Brother.
No, it's really good. We used to do that a lot in in the 80s and 90s, and then suddenly it went out of way, and then because of, yeah, custom, and then when COVID came, we thought we needed something to feel, you know, together again. We do value the togetherness a lot here in Denmark, so that's a thing we do thing together.
We'll meet again.
See, a local Chicago station did that too. It was like every Friday at like 6 or 7 p.m. you'd throw on the radio, blast it, and everybody would go outside and sing and dance.
Yeah, people need that, don't they? They need the catharsis.
Well, thank you guys. This was awesome as always.
Yeah, thank you, Marie.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Marie.
Bye, guys.
You did a good job.
Good night. Good whatever. Cheers.
If I saw Kristen go in front of me, I'd be suggesting a four-way.
Melos. What? Why is the Grand Maester called Melos? And is that's not a Westerosi name? Putting it out there. Elle, do you have a reasoning?
As in that he's maybe from Essos or something?
Yeah. So, if he is from there.
I mean, I don't know the out-of-state admission fees to the Citadel. Or anything like that, but I've, other than, you know, women not being able to come maesters, I haven't heard any, like, no foreigners. I mean, I know Westeros is extremely xenophobic, but I have not heard any kind of law custom down to where it's like Westerosi only or anything. So maybe that dude just came in on a scholarship or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he seems incompetent now. Honestly.
I mean, this may just be my suspicious nature, but I think he's kind of like low-key, kind of like not, if not trying to kill Viserys outright, certainly intentionally not helping him. Especially yeah. with the scene where the younger, you know, maester or the apprentice was kind of like, oh, well, you know, these herbal, let's try something. And he just kind of like shooed him away or like, shut the fuck up. Get out of the way kind of thing. So, I mean, that caught my attention. It could be nothing. It could be, you know, like anything else other than that. But I just kind of feel like that the Citadel and maybe with the help of Old Town and the High Towers had this big machinations of bringing down a Targaryen, starting with the dragons.
Yeah, that's a common theory, I think. I'm just wondering if there's any meaning behind him when he's here being not from Westeros. Because if he were like Bravosi, that would also be very much a thing that, you know, would support that he would, you know, try to knock off Viserys because they're very anti-dragons as well.
That's a really good point too. And you know, again, it's not like we haven't seen like a non-Westerosi person in like high levels of like power. I mean, there was someone from Essos that was on Jaehaerys's small council. Rhaegal, I think that was his name. Yeah. So I mean, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking it's I don't know. It's going to be I don't think it has any meaning to the show in general, that which is why I didn't mention it in the proper show, but I think it's interesting that he has a non-Westerosi name and he's clearly not doing his job.
Clearly not.
So, yeah.
I didn't get a lot of dragons, but I was surprised no one really commented on seeing Red Queen for the first time, even though it was, albeit very brief. But just seeing Melis fly, Rhaenys and Melis together flying, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on it either necessarily. I just thought that they looked quite similar, actually, in comparison to some of the other dragons that are very different. You know, Viserys's dragon, or no, Daemon's dragon, where it's very long-necked. Those two looked very similar, like maybe they were from the same clutch.
Yeah, I think even for a second, like Melis kind of looked like Drogon for like a half a second, like the same build, I thought. And then, of course, I went like, oh, I wonder, is that clutch? Does she, Melis, have a clutch somewhere? And could she be the egg mama? And, you know, things like that. But I thought that she was like really beautiful. And I know we're going to see her later. But I couldn't make out the second one. I'm assuming it was Sea Smoke.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I couldn't really make out the second one. But yeah, no, I was just happy to see him.
Yeah, and I like it that you the term they're using, egg mama. I like that. I will call it that from now on.
Egg mama, there you go.
Egg mama, yeah. Good.
Yeah, good show. What are y'all anticipating just from the trailer for next week?
I haven't watched the trailer.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, well, no spoilers.
No, as with in England, we don't get trailers connected to the show.
Really?
So you have to, yeah, you need to, like, literally seek them out.
Wow. And, okay. Okay, well, I shan't be spoiling anything in that case.
I'm assuming that the grown-up versions of Rhaenyra's and Alicent are amazingly talented actresses as well. I'm just gonna be sad to see those two go.
So am I. Especially specific for me, Millie. I thought she did an amazing job. Both of them, absolutely. But Millie was definitely a standout for me. I was always looking forward to seeing her these past couple of weeks. So it was good. It's gonna be pretty sad.
Yeah. But they do need a new actress to look as tired as Rhaenyra will look at the end.
Yeah.
Worn out. And
yeah, I don't think makeup could do that for her. So, yeah, they definitely needed to kind of edge that, kind of level up the stakes. I agree.